following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
Welcome to a brand new week, everyone. Same shit, different week. Here we go. Well, let's see, where were we? When we left on Friday, Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic leadership and the House of Representatives they were confident they were going to get their biff done. The progressives were saying, wait a minute, we had a deal. And, well, I hate to say it, the progressives caved. With the exception of six, let's see if I can do it from memory because I don't even have them in front of me. AOC, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley, Jamal Bowman, Cori Bush. That's the six. That's the six. Pramila Jayapal. She is the head. She is the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, which numbers about 90 members. And there were at least 20 who were not going to do it. And let's recap for a moment what went on. So going back months and months and months and months, they realized that they were going to split this big infrastructure deal that includes both hard infrastructure, roads, bridges, trains, and the human infrastructure part, that is healthcare, childcare, college, elder care, internet, things like that, that they'd have to split them in half because there's no way the obstructionist party would go along with it. What we didn't realize was that the obstructionist party infiltrated the Democratic Party as well. But they realize they'll split it in half. What they can get done through reconciliation, which is a budget process, they would do that way. And by doing it by reconciliation means that they only need 50 votes plus one, the vice president, to pass the legislation. That's how, you know, the last administration was able to get that $2 trillion tax cut for the uber wealthy through, because it was a budgetary thing. It only dealt with financials. And so they only needed 50 votes, 51, with the vice president as a tiebreaker if necessary. So that's what they did. Now, all along, from Biden on down, they were all insistent that these two bills go through the process in tandem, that one doesn't go without the other, so that each side, and by each side, I'm talking about the two sides of the Democratic Party, the progressives and the, I'll just call them conservadems, okay, so that each of them has leverage over the other one, right? The progressives didn't have much use for the biff, except for, you know, it does some good things, roads and bridges and trains, oh my. But the important work, the money for climate change mitigation, is not included in the biff. For that, they need the other part. So both sides must pass, was always the game plan. And Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi, they were saying those words all along. You'll recall before he left for Europe last week, it was just a week ago, Biden went to the Hill and spoke to the Democratic caucus, and he didn't say, pass this bill today. Now, some critics are saying that he should have, that he should have said this is urgent, because if he had, you know, one, maybe it would have been before the Virginia election and maybe they could have eked that out. But I don't think that the loss in Virginia was the fault of, you know, not having the biff done. I think it was merely the fact that Terry McAuliffe sucked as a candidate. He was awful years ago. He was still awful. And all he ran on was, I'm not Donald Trump. Donald Trump sucks. Well, you know what? That might have worked in 2020. It's not good enough now. And the Youngkin, or whatever his name was, although he is as bad as any Trumper, He learned how to moderate his remarks. He knew who the crowd he was speaking to was. The old adage, know your audience. He knew his audience. And he was able to sort of, keep Trump at an arm's length and win the election, but still spout the same horrible, Republican policies. So we're screwed. And not only did the Democrats lose the Virginia's governor's race, but they also lost the House, their assembly, which really sucks. Things are not going well. Let's put it that way. So then they go ahead and so six of the Democrats did not vote for this BIF, which could have been deadly. Now, I don't know what behind the scenes negotiations they did, because so much of this is gameplay. Seriously, so much of it is, it's political theater. So they got 13 Republicans to vote for this bill. So that meant they had 10 to play with, basically, because there's a 3-vote margin. I don't recall the House ever being so closely split, so evenly split. But Nancy Pelosi knew she could lose 3 votes. There were 6. I'm wondering if, say, they only had 5 Republicans, if one of those 6 would have given in. Like, remember how AOC voted present on a on something, because an Israel thing, I believe it was, because of her constituency. She knew, that she was on the wrong side of it, and she did what she had to do. Political expedience. It's the ugly thing about politics. As I've always said, I wish we could take the politics out of politics, but anyway, I don't know that we'll ever know the answer to that. Why Pramila Jayapal made this deal? Well, here's a little bit of what she said. I heard an interview with her yesterday. The person who did the interviewing wasn't great, but I love Pramila Jayapal, and she's always really good and pretty spot on. So here's what she had to say about what happened, just what happened on Friday night.
We have been committed to how we get both bills through. And I would just remind everybody that 4 weeks ago, we had nothing on Build Back Better.
That's
we had
true.
An infrastructure bill, but we had nothing on Build Back Better. We didn't have a framework. We didn't have legislative text. We certainly didn't have a vote on the floor. We didn't have any agreement that it was actually going to pass.
Right.
And what we were able to get last night is to the place where we were able to pass the infrastructure bill, get a firm commitment from all 6 moderates that they would vote for the rule. And, they were not wanting to vote for the bill at the time. They would vote for the rule. And that in 10 days that they would vote for the Build Back Better Act once they studied the scores. They needed some time to look at the numbers. But they would vote on it. And that is a commitment they made to me. It's a commitment they made to the president. And it's a commitment they put into writing. And so I think that we have to think about this as, what was our goal here?
Okay, what was our goal here? I thought our goal here was to get both parts passed. And the thing that I worry about now is that they've lost all their leverage. By they, I mean the progressives. So I mean, we've lost all our leverage. But okay, keep going, Pramila.
We, progressive leadership and moderate leadership, were able to get in the room. And when I say moderate leadership, I actually mean the 6 that were, there yet.
Oh,
we got
the
in a room together and we worked out this deal on our own. The president, of course, helped and was really important to that discussion. But really, this was about, can we look each other in the eye and start to reestablish trust? Because that is going to be essential for everything else we need to do. And there have been a lot of ways in which that trust has disintegrated. And I think this was a really important moment that I haven't seen anyone talking about yet, where we were saying, let's bring some creativity to the table in terms of how we solve this with the statement of agreement that they will vote for the bill. But also, let's start to look each other in the eye and not allow other people to come in and try to negotiate for us. Let's do it with each other. And I think that was a really important moment. I trust them completely. I will say that. I said that last night. I'll say it again. I trust that they looked me in the eye and said that they were going to pass the Build Back Better Act as soon as they had had a chance to look at the fiscal information. And that will be transformative.
It'll be transformative, but I'm always bringing up the buts. God. Sorry, the people she made the deal with were her House colleagues, were Democrats in the House Democratic Caucus. She didn't get any assurances from any Republicans that they'd be in on it. And more importantly, she got no assurances from the Senate. Again, these two bills were supposed to pass in concert. They were supposed to go together so that one wouldn't pass without the other. That's where the leverage came in. She caved. I love Pramila Jayapal, but she caved.
We will send it over to the Senate, just as we anticipated, with more in it, Alex, than even what was laid out in the Biden framework.
Okay.
So now we have paid leave in there. We have an agreement on pharmaceutical drug pricing. We have really a remarkable package that at this point is about $2.1
trillion.
So I think this is a really fantastic agreement for the American people. And delivering the infrastructure bill was a true honor to deliver that. Progressives delivered that bill. Without us, it would not have happened.
That's true.
And we delivered that bill to the president, and he's going to be able to sign it.
Okay, so a couple of things there. One, she said, we're sending it over to the Senate with so much more in it. Yeah, that's true. But the minute it lands in the Senate, they're going to start slashing it because you have no leverage over them to keep it intact. Joe Manchin gave no assurances. He said, I'm fine with nothing. He's fine with killing that bill in its entirety, even though there's a lot of money in it for West Virginia. So, and what was the last thing she said? I want to hear. The last thing she said was
bill to the president, and he's going to be able to sign it.
He's going to be able to sign it. Well, the thing is, he could have signed it today, right? It's Monday. He's at the White House. He's got the bill on his desk. He's got pens. But no signing of the bill. You know why? Because Congress... Sit down, because I know this is going to surprise you. Congress is on recess this week. Yeah. Let me pull out the calendar for a second. So today is November 8th, right? November 8th through November 12th, Congress is out. Both the House and the Senate, out. They're on vacation. That's why they stayed late Friday night to get this done, so that because some of them had plans, they were going out of the country, you know, vacation, because they work so damn hard that God forbid you take a day of their vacation away. Well, now remember, this Thursday is Veterans Day. That's a holiday. Maybe that's why they had to take the whole week off, because Veterans Day is a holiday. But 2 weeks later, 2 weeks to the day after Veterans Day, is Thanksgiving. And guess what? They're going to be out that week too. And it's not like they have any deadlines looming or anything. Oh, wait. December 3rd, the Friday after the Thanksgiving week Friday, there are a couple of little deadlines coming up. Like one, the government runs out of funding again. Remember how they didn't have a shutdown because they extended, they did a continuing resolution to keep the government open for a few more weeks. Well, that runs out December 3rd. And oh yeah, there's that other little pesky thing hanging around, the debt ceiling, which we will also hit right around December 3rd. It was extended because actually Mitch McConnell caved. And, you know, we should have hit the debt ceiling a couple of weeks ago, but Chucky Schmucky didn't want to put it into reconciliation, which, by the way, it wouldn't have gone through anyway because that hasn't passed yet. And it may not entirely. But the debt limit, we hit upon that on December 3rd. So can someone explain to me why Congress is on recess this week? I guess some of them will be back next week, the week of the 15th, but then they're all out again the week of the 22nd because it's Thanksgiving week. And then they come back for 2 weeks and then they're gone for Christmas. So what the fuck? Seriously, what the actual fuck? Did these people work? Because they're going to come back and go, oh my God, the sky is falling. We're going to run out of money, which they won't. The debt ceiling is going to implode on us. The whole thing is ridiculous. And yes, if the Republicans were in office, I'd be screaming the same way I am now, which I did. I always screamed about to Mitch McConnell, why the fuck are they on recess? They have work to do. I'm just livid about, can you tell? I'm kind of upset. It just makes no goddamn sense at all. None at all. Then, okay, so Jeffrey Kale in the YouTube chat room says, did the CBO ever score the military spending? No, because they don't care what impact it has on the, you know, yes, this $748 billion defense, national defense authorization bill for 1 year will add $748 billion to the deficit. They don't give a fuck. They don't care. And if you talk to Stephanie Kelton, you'll see it doesn't really matter. It just doesn't matter. We print the money. But the whole bullshit about this debt, the CBO score, oh, they have to have the CBO score. Why? You heard Pramila Jayapal say, we loaded it up with stuff. It's now over $2 trillion. Well, Joe Manchin said he won't go above 1.5. And maybe Joe Biden thinks he got him up to 1.75. Ooh. So why they need to wait for the CBO to score it, it's a moot point. Because the minute that bill gets over to the Senate, they're going to pull out the knives and start slashing and cutting and slashing and cutting and slashing and cutting. And the CBO is going to have to score it again. So this was nothing more than a delay tactic on the part of those six conservadems. That includes Schrader from Oregon, Stephanie Murphy from Florida, and I don't know, a handful, Spanberger, Slotkin. Yeah, ick. I mean, come on, man. Really?
Come on, man.
Come on, man. What the hell? You know, it's like, it doesn't matter who's in office, but it does. Because the other side, because our side is fucked up and ineffectual, and we need a complete change in leadership. We need new young blood. But the Republicans are, my God, they want to destroy democracy entirely. They want to keep us from voting. They want to have the ability that if an election is held and they don't like the outcome, that their partisan officials can step in and just put in their own electors and change the results to something that they're happy with. And this is not hyperbole. I'm not making this up. This is what's going on. And yet, Joe Biden holds a press conference Saturday morning. You heard this, right? Had a press conference to tout the BIF, which stands for a bipartisan framework. It's not a framework. They don't have a fucking name for the stupid thing, the infrastructure bill, the hard infrastructure bill. So Joe Biden's like, we got this great victory and da, da, da. And of course, I don't even know if he meant, I don't think he mentioned the other part of it. That's the more important stuff that's still hanging in the balance. That again, that he's not going to sign for another week because Congress is on vacation and he needs the photo op. Really, there was that urgency to get it done, get it done, get it done so we can get it started. But oh, you got to wait a week so we can take the picture with everybody responsible for pushing this shit through. And then I'll sign it. And then, you know, it's only delayed another week. What? Who cares? Who else's brain is exploding? Because I know mine is. Oh, man. And there was one other thing I was going to get to, and I just lost my train of thought again. It's just one frustrating thing after another. But the other part is, so if the Republicans were in office, it would be exponentially worse because the things that they're trying to do that at least some Democrats are putting up a little bit of a fight about, they would just push through. Killing your voting rights. Rewriting American history and the textbooks along with it, because, you know, they're using the code term critical race theory, which doesn't exist except in some, you know, graduate college work, law school. But they're scaring parents. Oh, my God, they're going to teach about what really happened in slavery. They're going to ban books because they don't want your kid reading beloved by Toni Morrison? You know, there were some people, and I'll go there, the Susan Sarandons of the world, who said, you know what, maybe we need just, we need to hit rock bottom. We need to get go so bad so people realize what's possible, and then they'll come back and, okay, so when is it bad enough? We had 4 years of Trump. Now, thankfully, the masses rose up to vote him out of office. Unfortunately, and I know I'm going to piss off some listeners, but we picked the wrong guy. Joe Biden, I think his heart is in the right place. I think he wants to do the things he said he's going to do. But I don't think he's capable, frankly. I just don't. We've shot ourselves in the foot so many times. And I think we did it. This nice enough guy, but the wrong man for the time. The wrong person for the job. And Kamala Harris, have you seen the latest polling numbers? Not that I put much credence in polls, but it does give you a snapshot of where the country is at any particular moment. Joe Biden's ratings are down to like the 30s, like 37% or something. The only thing that's worse, Kamala Harris's numbers. She's in the high 20s. We are so fucked, and not in a good way. I honestly don't know how we crawl out of this. The only and the media's line is to push everything on the progressives. Oh, it's the progressives who did this. Did you see Mark Penn, the idiot Mark Penn, the guy who ran Hillary Clinton's 2012 race, writes an op-ed in the New York Times blaming the progressives. Why? Because the conservative Dems, or someone in the chat room said the corporate Dems killed the, and I shouldn't speak of it as if it's dead. You know, I should have Pramila Jayapal's optimism. I just find it really hard to be optimistic in times like this. It's really fucking hard. Brandon is beating Trump. You know, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know the answer. Yes, Ms. Harris is invisible. For a president who trotted her out at every turn at the beginning, now she stands there with her mask on and she pretty much is invisible. I don't know what's going on with her. I don't. And then there are these trials going on. The fact that Kyle Rittenhouse has become a cult pop hero to the right just tells you so much what you need to know about society today. And it's not a world that I like living in very much. This is a kid who went from his neighboring state of Illinois into Kenosha, Wisconsin, complete with an AR-15 driven there by his mother because he was underage, to go help the police protect the streets against those horrible protesters who were protesting the police shooting another innocent black man in Kenosha, Wisconsin. This was not Kyle Rittenhouse's fight. He had no horse in this race. He had no skin in this game. Yet he's there and claiming self-defense. I talk about opposite world all the time. I'm going to have to assemble a list because every time I turn around, there's another example of it. It's astounding to me. It's just astounding to me. I'm losing my patience. And I'm laughing because I don't have patience. Oh, let me share this headline that just crossed my screen moments before I came on the air. Northern Ireland health czar suing Van Morrison over COVID rhetoric. This is so upsetting to me. You don't know. I'm a huge Van Morrison fan. Well, I was. Moondance, one of my favorite albums of all time, and others. But, you know, that one grabbed me when I was like 12 or something, and it never let go. Let me just read to you. Northern Ireland's health minister has filed a defamation lawsuit against Van Morrison after the singer called him, quote, a fraud, and his handling of coronavirus restrictions, quote, very dangerous. Health Minister Robert Swan's legal action is in response to a June appearance by Morrison at the Europa Hotel in Belfast after the last-minute cancellation of one of his concerts due to COVID-19 regulations. In viral footage of the incident, Morrison can be seen leading a cheering audience chanting, "Robin Swan is very dangerous." A libel lawyer, Paul Tweed, who's representing Swan, confirmed to a newspaper that the lawsuit had been filed with the aim to have a trial in February. Morrison's attorney told the AP that the singer's words, quote, constituted fair comment. The 76-year-old Morrison has largely been dismissive of the pandemic. He's been an outspoken critic of restrictions, writing a number of anti-lockdown songs with lyrics about scientists, quote, making up crooked facts to enslave the population. Oh, my God. In an op-ed for Rolling Stone last September, Swan, the health minister of Northern Ireland, alternatively bemoaned and lambasted the singer's behavior, calling it bizarre and irresponsible. His songs about the fascist bullies in government, Swan wrote, would give great comfort to the conspiracy theorists who crusade against masks and vaccines. We live in opposite world. Things are just bizarre. People are so messed up. I just honestly, I don't know which way to turn anymore. I really don't. So today we have a guest coming up in a few minutes. Somebody I've known for many years. Her name is R.L. Miller, and she's an environmentalist. And in fact, maybe a dozen years ago or so now, she founded an organization called Climate Hawks Vote. Their website is climatehawksvote.com. And, well, their vision is, you know, their area of concern, obviously, is the climate. And they deal with political campaigns using people who are concerned about what's happening with our climate to use their vote to get the elected people to do what we need them to do. All right. So I reached out to RL because she had a Twitter thread up today, basically talking about the BIF. It's the only thing I can call it because that's what it's called, the BIF, because about how what effect the BIF is having or will have on the climate. And Biden and the officials who are touting the passage of this bill are talking about all the good things it'll do for climate. Well, that's not true. That's
bullshit.
You see, the good stuff is in the reconciliation part of the bill, the Build Back Better plan. God, I hate the names. We need better positioning, messaging people on the left. I know we have them. But so anyway, she's going to come on and talk about that. Before she gets here, though, one last bit of breaking news that just broke moments before I hit the air. And that is the Select Committee investigating January 6th issued 6 more subpoenas today. And these are good ones. Here's who they go to. John Eastman. That's the guy who drafted the memo advising the Trump campaign both to use the vice presidential authority to push back on election results and to get the state legislatures to reject electors from certain states in order to deny Biden a majority of the Electoral College vote and thereby overturn the election. It was his plan that he admitted to Lauren Windsor was the goal all along. So he got a subpoena. Bill Stepien, remember him? He managed Trump's 2020 campaign. He was also the guy behind Bridgegate, if I remember correctly, for Chris Christie. Jason Miller, a senior advisor to the campaign, and Angela McCollum, a Trump campaign assistant, all got subpoenas, as did Michael Flynn. Michael Flynn, who briefly served as Trump's national security advisor and who the committee said reportedly attended a December meeting at the White House during which participants discussed declaring a national emergency as a route for seizing voting machines. Michael Flynn got a subpoena. And the sixth one went to Bernard Carrick, former New York City police chief, an associate of Rudy Giuliani's, who reportedly attended the January 5th meeting at the war room they had set up at the Willard Hotel, and he paid for rooms and suites in that hotel that served as an election-related command center. Those six have been subpoenaed. That's a big deal. The problem? There's no mechanism to carry out these subpoenas, to enforce them. There's no enforcement mechanism. And the Senate, the committee refuses to invoke inherent contempt. You know why? They say, well, it hasn't been used in almost 100 years. Well, maybe it hasn't been needed in almost 100 years. Now they need it, so get it done. I don't understand the toothlessness of these people. They have the tools there. Use them, right? I just don't get it. All right, so I see R.L. Miller is here. Now, R.L., before I bring you in, there's a video that I want to play for you because I want to get your take on it. And it's something that actually you may be able to use in your travels. You know what, before I bring it, since I'm already talking to you, let me just bring you on and we can say hello very quickly. And then I'll play the video so everyone can see it. R.L. Miller, founder of Climate Hawks Vote. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And it's good to see you again. It's been a long time.
Yeah, it's been years.
Yeah, it has. Well, and you've been doing Climate Hawks Vote. You put that organization together. It's got to be, I was saying, about a dozen years ago at least, right?
Not quite. No? We hatched in 2014. The idea is simply to build grassroots political power for the climate movement.
Okay. Cool. Oh, 2014. So, okay. So 8 years, almost a dozen. Yeah. Close. A presidential term, that's for sure. All right. So this is an ad. I don't know if you've seen these people before, but they do these ads from time to time, usually dealing with the Australian government. But now it's just the government who they're talking about. And they want the government to, to get honest, please. So let me share this with you. I think you'll enjoy it. Just listen to what the woman has to say. Here we go.
With an update on how we're handling the climate crisis. We know you're all counting on us to solve this problem so humanity can keep enjoying its favorite pastime, continuing to live on this planet. But you see, we've realized that we are the problem. And so, how should we put this? We're actually going to get us all killed. Look at this graph shaped like a penis because it shows how fucked we are. This is where we are now. And as we can see, it's already pretty fucked with massive fires, floods, heat waves, locusts, bullshit. This is what scientists call the stop here or we're fucked point. And this is where we're currently headed. Or as scientists call it, net fucked by 2050. The good news is we've promised to reduce our emissions. And if you take all our promises and add them together, that puts us on track for still very much fucked by 2050. And that's if we keep our promises. A big if, since some of our biggest promises are being coke blocked by corporate coal shills, while others are nothing more than blah blah blah, or a plan printed on a pamphlet.
Planflet?
Our promises and planflets are also based on the hope that we'll offset our emissions with technologies which don't work or even fucking exist. Or with technologies that do work and exist. Like trees. Except trees need time to grow, which we don't have. And space, which we also don't have. Plus, trees can burn, which seems to happen a lot these days due to
climate change.
And when they do, they release all that carbon they captured. Which means the only way we can keep our promises is to stop emitting carbon. Are we doing that? God, no. We've been subsidizing it at a rate of $11 million per minute, which discourages investment in renewables by distorting the market. And that's why there's a huge gap between our promises and where we need to be. We don't talk about that gap because that would entail a complex process called being honest. Being honest would mean admitting that we're failing. And we can't do that because then we'd have to stop failing. That would mean ending fossil fuel subsidies and banning all new gas, coal, and oil projects. And listen to anyone suggesting harming our precious children like that. We say, how dare you? So being honest isn't an option for us, which is why we've come up with the next best alternative. Net Zero by 2050. Net Zero by 2050 means that instead of being honest this decade by taking this path, we leave the being honest part to the last minute by taking that path instead. As you can see, both lead to net zero in 2050, but they're very different journeys, because this path adds this many emissions to the atmosphere, and that one adds three times as much. And since emissions are what's causing the planet to warm, that means crossing the stop here or we're fucked point, which risks setting off irreversible chain reactions beyond our control. That's the exciting part of running an experiment with the only planet we know that supports life in the whole fucking universe, just so we can make a few billionaires even richer. Net Zero by 2050. Anywho, feel free to take over from us at any time, because as you can see, we're captured by the fossil fuel industry, compromised by our moral failings and lack of vision, and probably going to get us all killed. Oh. This has been a message from your local government franchise. Goodbye.
Authorized by the Department for blah, blah, blah.
Greta Thunberg at the end there. Authorized by the government of blah, blah, blah. That's a production of The Juice Media. They're on Patreon, patreon.com, The Juice Media. Quite brilliant, I think. RL, it does the job, doesn't it? Gets the message across. Oh, you're muted, I think. You're muted somehow.
There we go.
There you go.
I love their work. They put out something a few months ago on carbon capture and storage, about capturing politicians and storing the money in their offshore accounts.
Yeah, they're great. And honestly, I don't know much about them, but I need to find out. It's like I said, it's usually the Australian government, spelled Austral, L-I-E-N instead of L-I-A-N. But I need to find out about this company, because these things are brilliant. And this one I just saw this morning and I thought, oh my God, I got to play that for you. It's a perfect way to lead into the segment. We're kind of fucked, to use her vernacular.
Yeah. And what do we have to show for it so far, to quote The Juice? Fuck all.
That's right.
Am I allowed to say that on the radio?
You are, because we're internet. So thankfully, okay, I don't have the FCC fucking with me all the time. So RL, you know, I called you, I emailed you or texted, messaged you this morning, because I saw the thread that you put up on Twitter about you hashtagged it 325-1, and you can explain why in a moment. But this is all about this. I was just railing about the BIF. So they passed the BIF at the expense of, apparently, you know, the other priorities, including climate change mitigation. I mean, all the money for funding our efforts to combat climate change are in the other part of the bill that the progressives just gave up all the leverage they had in getting it passed. So I'm not feeling too optimistic about it right now, but they are touting great achievements from the BIF. You want to tell us what climate achievements are in the BIF?
Fuck all?
Fuck all.
Well, seriously, there is some money for electric buses.
Okay.
And some money also for buses that are cleaner, but not actually clean. That's a different story. Mm-hmm. And there's some money for electric vehicle charging stations. And that's good.
That is good.
It's about, it adds up to about $15 billion. The problem is, and so the White House is messaging all this, and the Democrats are spinning this as we're acting on climate. And that's good. And then there's a bunch of stuff that isn't really climate, but they're calling it climate. So if you repave a road, it's infrastructure. Mm-hmm. But if you repave a road that's been flooded, it's climate resilience.
Oh, God. Really?
Right. And so you see that this is like really ripe for bullshit.
Yes.
You know, if you build a higher seawall, in front of a bunch of rich people's homes, it's actually a horrible idea, but that's a different story. But that's resilience. And so they're touting a lot of, you know, if a bridge has washed away because of a 100-year storm and they rebuild the bridge, that's climate. And so they're touting a lot of stuff that is not climate as climate resilience. a lot of the what you would think of as common or garden variety infrastructure, they're calling it resilience. That's not the part that bothers me. The part that really bothers me is there's a ton of money in that bill for bad things. And by bad things, I specifically mean carbon capture and storage.
Okay.
Something called direct air capture.
Yes.
A bunch of bad things. And
$6 billion in subsidies for nuclear reactors
that are not economically viable in today's markets.
Right.
Isn't this like actual socialism as opposed to what Republicans call socialism?
You have $2.1 billion for, quote, carbon dioxide transportation infrastructure finance and innovation, go ahead. What is this with?
And somebody tried explaining to me that it's pipelines. And I said, no, it's bullshit.
you wrote on Twitter, which generally seems to be S-799 by Senator Chris Coons. And I have no idea what all that noun string word salad means.
Okay. Right. And so, like I said, one of the smart people who follows me on Twitter who thinks it's a good idea tried explaining that it's pipelines to take carbon that is emitted at a steel plant and transport it somewhere far away and store it underground. And I thought, yeah, but that's still bullshit.
Right. Right. What are DAC hubs?
I don't know exactly, except, well, they're bribes.
Okay. Yep, there you go.
Right. What they mean by hubs is they send a bunch of money to some university or something to go build a project and hire a bunch of people to study stuff or maybe actually do stuff. They put in a climate hub at UC Davis. I graduated from that one, so I paid a little bit of attention to it. And I don't really know what it does other than keep some professors and undergrads employed, which I guess is a good thing. But now, don't get me wrong, this is a bribe. And somebody, likely John Garamendi, who represents UC Davis, fought for it. And part of me, the cynical part of me, thinks that when we're talking about solar research and development money and wind research and development money, there's $100 million in the BIF for that. Let's put these research hubs in West Virginia.
Yeah.
Let's bribe Joe Manchin if that's what it takes.
Why Joe Biden hadn't done that already? I've been saying he needs to whip out his inner LBJ. However that might manifest itself, but do something. Instead, you got Joe Biden as recently as Friday saying, I don't care if we don't get the social spending bill, which is what they call it. The other thing is it would be nice to have like legitimate, easy to understand and descriptive names for these bills. Instead, we have the BIF, which stood for Bipartisan Infrastructure Framework. And that's the best. That's the one that stuck. And the other one is the reconciliation package. It's the social spending bill or the Build Back Better bill, which I'm sorry, none of them says a damn thing other than we're confused and we don't know what to call it.
And I actually think it's not bad to call it the BIF because nobody understands what it's about anyways. So you might as well call it something that's meaningless.
Right, right. Now, you also point out, and I didn't realize this, in this Twitter thread that I will link to on the blog today at NicoleSandler.com where I post the show. The Intercept added that the BIF creates, I want to get the number, $25 billion in new fossil fuel subsidies?
What? That's the carbon capture and storage. That's the... that's the direct air capture and that word salad pipeline, carbon dioxide pipeline to nowhere.
Wow.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong. Some of this stuff is good.
Right. Some of it's very good and necessary. Yeah. But, you know, they're celebrating this and calling it a climate bill, which it is not. The other one, the reconciliation bill, the Build Back Better Act, whatever you want to call it, is But with each passing day, I think the chances of it getting passed, and certainly passed in the form in which the House is sending it over to the Senate, where they're, look, I love Pramila Jayapal, but she's bragging. Oh, we put paid family leave back in there. We put, expansion of Medicare back in. We put all this stuff back in there. So it's over a $2 trillion package again. And does she think they're not going to immediately take a knife to it and start slashing away the second they get it?
Inclined to trust Pramila Jayapal.
Well, so am I. I mean, I love her.
She's done a great job of holding the Progressive Caucus together and keeping them fierce. And my sense is that she wouldn't have folded. I hate to use the word folded, but I think she wouldn't have dropped the hold the line if she hadn't gotten really rock solid assurances from the White House. And from Joe Manchin. All I can say is that I hope she got something signed in blood.
I think she got nothing from Joe Manchin. I think she got nothing from the Senate. What she got were assurances from the conservadem or corporate dem part of the Democratic caucus that they'll vote for it. So it'll pass out of the House. I think she got nothing from the Senate. And Biden told her, we need something. We're getting killed. We need to pass this. You need to do it. And she gave in. That's my belief.
I fear you're right. I still think that what we all need to do is continue to press for Build Back Better. It will, in fact, be a wonderful bill if it is passed. My general understanding is that the climate part of it is pretty baked in. They're still negotiating immigration and some paid family leave matters,
right?
Which... I think immigration is just hard for a reconciliation bill.
Right, and the parliamentarian already said no twice to immigration. That's going to be cut out. But they put it in to get it out of the House again or whatever. I don't know. So let me ask you this. So you've got this long Twitter thread. There's a whole bunch of stuff in there. A lot of, a lot of important truths that people need to understand. But you hashtagged it. 325-1. Now, I love what this is about. Explain, because it's an obscure hashtag. What is this about?
So, back in 2019, I got really angry at the way then DNC chair Tom Perez was handling what I call the DNC climate debacle. We outside advocates did everything right. We delivered 225,000 signatures demanding a climate debate. I am a California Democratic Party insider.
Okay.
And I know that Democrats speak in the language of resolutions. And I drafted a template resolution calling on my local DNC members to back a climate debate. And I circulated that around and it got passed by the state parties of, I think, Utah, Maryland, the Young Democrats of America, Democratic central county and state parties across the nation, Tennessee, Arizona, everywhere. People loved the idea. And he still said no. And so I got so angry that I decided to run for DNC myself.
Nice.
I wanted to tell him to fuck off to his face instead of telling him online.
Yeah.
And I ended up winning. In California, we vote in a number of DNC reps. There's an elite electorate of the Democratic Party insiders, and I convinced enough of them that I'd be fierce on climate and everything else. And so I ran for DNC. And so now, unfortunately, I never did get a chance to say anything to Tom Perez because COVID put an end to that.
Well, good. That's good because I'm so glad he's not in there. But we have Jamie Harrison now. Is he any better?
So far, he's not going to be good on climate. But he does have some positive ideas about not giving up on the red states. And, you're in Florida, right? that the world tends to resolve around, the political world tends to revolve around only about six states, which might be, Arizona, Georgia, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, North Carolina. and maybe Florida and maybe Ohio.
Right.
And we tend to forget about the blue states. And we also tend to forget about the red states, the places like Texas, mm-hmm. places like Wyoming. And he's got some ideas about bringing them along and making sure that Democrats in those red states, in places like South Carolina, feel represented. So I'm keeping an open mind on Jamie Harrison right now. I do think that he's got some good ideas for the Democratic Party. I think he needs some more education on climate.
Well, yeah, so do a lot of them, unfortunately.
Right.
And maybe, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And so he took a resolution that I saw in its draft form. It was just something about how DNC should consider doing virtual Zoom meetings all the time to reduce our carbon footprint, which I didn't think was a terribly good idea in the first place. But he took it and he vastly rewrote it to instead make it a resolution saying that the Democrats think that BIF is an awesome climate bill.
Oh, God.
And I said, what?
Oh, no.
It's not a climate bill. No. And I tried to be heard, but the DNC Resolutions Committee is incredibly performative. Mm-hmm. They don't actually allow people to make comments at all, whether you're a DNC member or not.
Right.
You have to be actually on the committee. And then I tried to speak out at the DNC meeting, and I still couldn't be recognized. Now, granted, I was calling in from some random EV charging stop in Utah where the internet was pretty dubious. And maybe that was why, but I was not heard. And so when they put up the resolutions package, it passed 325 to me.
So that's the hashtag 325-1.
Right.
That's awesome.
People were saying this is like the Barbara Lee vote against the Iraq war. And I'm saying I'm not in the same category as Barbara Lee.
Right.
She is awesome. I am just a new DNC member with a point of view.
I hear. Well, I'll tell you something. If they need to listen to somebody, I just pulled a clip. Obviously, COP26 is going on to mixed reviews, but I have one review that I want to share. It's just a quick, like 2.5 minute video, but let me share this. It's everyone's favorite teenage climate activist, Greta Thunberg. And here's what she had to say.
It is not a secret that COP26 is a failure. It should be obvious that we cannot solve a crisis with the same methods that got us into it in the first place. And more people are starting to realize this. Many are starting to ask themselves, what will it take for the people in power to wake up? But let's be clear, they are already awake. They know exactly what they are doing. This is no longer a climate conference. This is now a Global North Greenwash Festival.
Ooh.
A 2-week-long celebration of business as usual and blah, blah, blah.
Blah, blah, blah.
The most affected people in the most affected areas still remain unheard. And the voices of future generations are drowning in their greenwash and empty words and promises. But the facts do not lie. And we know that our emperors are naked. To stay below the targets set in the Paris Agreement and thereby minimizing the risk of setting off irreversible chain reactions beyond human control, we need immediate, drastic, annual emission cuts unlike anything the world has ever seen. And as we don't have the technological solutions that alone will do anything even close to that, that means we will have to fundamentally change our society. Mm. And this is the uncomfortable result of our leaders' repeated failure to address this crisis. And the climate and ecological crisis, of course, doesn't exist in a vacuum. It is directly tied to other crises and injustices that date back to colonialism and beyond. Crises based on the idea that some people are worth more than others and therefore have the right to steal others, to exploit others, and to steal their land and resources. And it is very naive of us to think that we could solve this crisis without addressing the root cause of it. And the question we must now ask ourselves is, what is it that we are fighting for?
What is it that we are fighting for?
Are we fighting to save ourselves and the living planet? Or are we fighting to maintain business as usual? They cannot ignore our screams as we reclaim our power. We are tired of their blah, blah, blah. Our leaders are not leading. This is what leadership looks like.
That is what leadership looks like. And I'm just so excited for the time when these young people get to take over. I mean, even here, you look at the younger members of Congress. They've at least got direction. They have motivation. They have energy. And you look at the leadership, and I just want to say, go home and play with your grandchildren. R.L. Miller.
It's so frustrating. I am a Woolsey fire survivor. I had flames within 500 feet of my home during one of the California wildfires a couple of years ago. And so when you talk about climate change as something that the next generation is facing, I will tell you from California that I've talked to enough people in the state that I can state with confidence that all of us have either been directly affected by climate change, or we know somebody who has. If you're not being evacuated from the Sonoma County wildfire, or the Ventura County wildfire, or the Yosemite wildfire, or the Far North wildfire, or the ones in Los Angeles County, then you're choking on the air that it's causing.
Right.
You know, and everybody here is being affected, and we all know it. And so one of the messages I am hoping to convey to people in power, whether it's at the DNC or Glasgow or wherever, is this is not a can to be kicking down the road to 2050 with all this net zero garbage. This is happening to real people right now in America. I'm one of them.
Yep.
And I'm angry. And so
as we all should be, and you know, we all should be, you know, I'm in Florida where I am. So far, you know, knocking on wood, laminate, but you go down to Miami Beach and it doesn't even have to be high tide anymore. The streets are flooded. You know, and they're still just building high rises on the beach like nothing. Where that condo collapsed, there's a bidding war to put up some other monstrosity on that site. They just don't learn their lesson. And I really think the only people that get it are the younger kids who are ready to step up. What the Sunrise Foundation, they're doing some really good work, aren't they? I mean, young people are the ones who are motivated. And I don't understand why we don't give them more power, frankly, because they're the ones who are going to change the world. We certainly didn't do it.
Old people vote. Young people don't turn out.
I know.
That's the stereotype. I founded Climate Hawks Vote with the idea of building grassroots political power for the climate movement. In plain English, that means I try to identify people who are going to be really fierce on climate, and I try to get them elected. This was an off year. We endorsed Michelle Wu for mayor of Boston because she was explicitly running on a Green New Deal, and she was the only person in this past election who was really running on climate. Terry McAuliffe was not running on
climate. But he was running on, I'm not Donald Trump.
Ooh. Yeah, which turned out to be lame.
You think?
Earlier this year, we endorsed Melanie Stansbury to take over Deb Holland's seat when Deb got nominated to be Secretary of the Interior. And Melanie is a water scientist and she's fierce. Next, you know, but this is just off year stuff. Obviously, next year is going to be the big year where we try to make sure that we no longer have a 51-50 Senate. We need to get a few more real Democratic senators in there. And I'm not talking about Joe or Kristen as real.
No, we need to replace them. But what I'm saying, replacing, either one of them are on the ballot next year. We need to bring our numbers up enough that their votes don't matter and they don't get to hold the rest of us hostage.
Right. And I do that in part by educating people where people and candidate in primaries stand on climate change. Climate Hawks Vote does go into primaries I'm happy to endorse a better Democrat over a mediocre Democrat.
Love it.
I know that after being on your show, because you've got a wide audience, I'm going to get deluged with emails, but you can follow me on Twitter at @RL_Miller. Look for that hashtag 325221.
#325TO1. Follow RL Miller and on Twitter, and go to climatehawksvote.com and see. I mean, the candidates you endorse are very much in line with the Blue America candidates that Howie Klein's my regular Thursday guest. So we push a lot of them, and they seem to have a lot of overlap there. RL Miller, it's great to talk to you. Thank you for the work you're doing. It is so important, and that's why I wanted to make sure my listeners knew of the work you're doing.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's good to hear from you again.
You too. You take care, RL. Thanks again.
Take care.
Bye-bye. All right. And with that, we've reached the end of another jam-packed hour. Thank you to RL Miller. Thanks to you guys. Tomorrow's Tuesday. Got a laugh. We'll be back. That's good. And I'm going to leave you with the news. All right. Have a great night, everyone. I'll see you tomorrow. Maybe? Yeah. No, we'll be here. I'll see you tomorrow. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Lawmakers in the House on Friday approved a $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill, sending President Biden a key piece of his agenda for his signature. This legislation includes projects to improve U.S. roads, bridges, pipes, ports, and internet access. Democrats repeatedly delayed the vote as they negotiated the larger Build Back Better plan. That's currently a $1.75 trillion human infrastructure plan that'll expand the social safety net and fight climate change. So the deal was made months ago that the two parts of the president's agenda would be voted on in tandem, giving both sides leverage in getting their priorities passed. But a group of six conservative Democrats on Friday delayed a vote on the Build Back Better reconciliation package, saying that they wanted to see a CBO score first, which could take 2 weeks. The nonpartisan Joint Committee on Taxation already determined that the bill was paid for. That should have been enough, given that the Senate will make changes, rendering any score by the Congressional Budget Office moot anyway. Given the defeats in last week's elections, the pressure was mounting to get something to the president's desk. So most of the Progressive Caucus caved. They're choosing to trust that the rest of the party will stand by the deal and pass that Build Back Better bill before November 15th. Pramila Jayapal chairs the Congressional Progressive Caucus.
We, progressive leadership and moderate leadership, were able to get in the room. And when I say moderate leadership, I actually mean the six that were not there yet. We got in a room together and we worked out this deal on our own. The president, of course, helped and was really important to that discussion. But really, this was about, can we look each other in the eye and start to reestablish trust? Because that is going to be essential for everything else we need to do. And there have been a lot of ways in which that trust has disintegrated. And I think this was a really important moment that I haven't seen anyone talking about yet. I trust them completely. I trust that they looked me in the eye and said that they were going to pass the Build Back Better Act as soon as they had had a chance to look at the fiscal information. And that will be transformative.
On Saturday, President Biden celebrated the approval of the infrastructure deal after months of infighting among Democrats. 13 Republicans voted with all but six of the House Democrats to pass the bill. And though President Biden has the hard infrastructure bill on his desk ready for his signature, he's not signing it yet. Why? Because Congress is on recess this week. And you know, you got to have that photo op. So what's another week's long delay in getting these projects started? My question is, why are they on recess? December 3rd is looming. That's the day that we hit deadlines on both a funding bill to keep the government going and when we hit the debt ceiling again. But hey, recess this week and then another week for Thanksgiving? December 3rd is looming. Something's wrong with this picture. There is some good economic news hitting just as the weekend was starting. Employers adding 531,000 jobs in October, the most since July. The hiring exceeded economists' expectations by almost 100,000 jobs and marked a rebound from disappointing September gains. But the Labor Department also increased its August and September estimates by a combined 235,000 jobs. The unemployment rate fell from 4.8% to 4.6%. signaling that the hiring is rebounding as the summertime coronavirus surge driven by the Delta variant has eased. Well, the COP26 climate summit continues in Glasgow, entering its second week in the wake of protests over the weekend. Climate activist Greta Thunberg led a massive protest of young activists outside of the summit on Friday. Thunberg, calling the conference a failure, said that world leaders should be taking bold action to prevent catastrophic climate change. Instead, she said, quote, history will judge them poorly because they're turning the potentially pivotal conference into a, quote, global greenwash festival and a, quote, two-week-long celebration of business as usual. Ooh. Following Friday's protest, an estimated 100,000 climate activists came out to protest on Saturday. Airports and customs lines will likely be busier than they've been in almost 2 years today as the United States lifts a 20-month-old coronavirus travel restriction on foreign visitors, now allowing vaccinated non-U.S. citizens from 33 countries to enter the U.S., being eliminated is a ban imposed by the Trump administration, and accepting fully vaccinated travelers from previously restricted countries, including China, India, and much of Europe, at airports and land borders. The policy was enforced to curb coronavirus infections, but it dealt a major blow to tourism and kept people from visiting family. Airlines and the Biden administration said they expected bottlenecks at first as travel demand surged and airlines checked vaccination documentation. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is fully listener-supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.